Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Ben Yanowitz
and Zach Smerin. In the reverse of last episode, Ben is on his own, interviewing three organizers of the Sirpad Collective, a queer anti-Zionist and diasporist Jewish group in Spain.
In our conversation, we delved into the rich history of Jews in Spain, from the Sephardic diaspora to the present, to uncover the way in which Jewish diaspora has contributed to Spanish culture and continues to challenge its monolithic nationalism.
The name Sirpad comes from the Hebrew for stinging nettle, and the reason for this is apparently because it's the only plant that a kibbutz is not named after. For British listeners, does this not give off a little bit of Judas energy?
Deeper than that, stinging nettle is a highly nutritious and medicinal plant that, if you don't treat correctly, will make its presence known with a sharp sting. Our guests hope that Sirpad will sting other Jews to realize the inadequacy and dangers posed by Zionism.
There is at least one significant omission in this discussion, and that is of the Spanish Civil War and the resulting era of Spanish fascism. As there is so much to discuss in regards to this topic, we will return to cover this era of Spanish Jewry in the future.
Thank you so much to our donors. If you like what we are doing here, please rate our show on your podcast platform of choice, consider supporting us on Patreon, and share our content with your communities.
And shout out to @immigrantsong for correctly guessing our previous episode's guest. We wish to engage more with our Instagram in the near future, so make sure to follow us there @thejewishdiasporistpod.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the conversation.
It's up to us to call ourselves to task, to sing what's good and true, to bring about redemption. It's what we were freed to do. For what's the point of being here if we're not moved to change our ways? Aleinu l'shabeach. It's time to live our praise.
Haiti, Levi, Ledise, it's really wonderful to sit down with you guys. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. The history of Jews in Spain, or Sephard as it's been called historically, is one of rich vibrancy, but also one of tragedy and expulsion. As we know, the Spanish Inquisition of the 1490s was, in many respects, the Holocaust before the Holocaust took place. But as you guys seek to organize the Jewish community along queer and diasporous lines, you carry this legacy within a constantly changing global and Jewish context. So to begin, could you each tell us a little bit about your family histories? And after you've all shared a little bit on this, how that history relates to your collective's understanding of diasporism?
Okay, my family. I was born in a profoundly Catholic family where Jewishness was not discussed at all at any moment. But growing up in Mallorca, I'm from Mallorca, the island in the Mediterranean, I started learning about Jewish hatred and specifically discrimination against chuetas, which is how the Jewish community is called in Mallorca. And I started to connect the dots. And someday I ended up going to the synagogue in the city and trying to get information from my elders and the people in my family without them knowing what I was actually trying to do. And then I discovered that my family, the one, because half of my family is not from the island, but the one that is directly descendant of those Jewish families that were forced to convert to Catholic tradition in order to be able to stay in the island. And that's when I started to understand why the way Christianity was practiced in my mom's side of the family and in my dad's side of the family was completely different. And to surprise of no one, the side of my family with Jewish roots had a Christianity with a lot of focus on how we're perceived from the outside, like trying to look and act as a good Christian, being the appearance of the family more important than the actual practice or how you relate to God and everything else. And on my mom's side of the family, it's more of a, everyone has their own unique connection to God and they just happen to go to church instead of going to somewhere else. But it's not like the whole family image is rest on your shoulders if you're not a good Christian like the rest of them.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that about you. Just out of curiosity, I've heard a lot about the crypto Jews and Maranos, those communities that adopted Christianity as a way to kind of stay in Spain amidst the expulsion and Inquisition. Do you know if there were any practices that were coming from the Jewish tradition, or was it like just a really attentiveness towards appearances of being Christian?
I would say the things that is most obvious in my family is something that is also done in other families in the area, is the fact that the cleaning day of the whole house, and like when you deep clean and you take everything out and you change the sheets and you open all your windows, it always falls on Saturday, and it's actually called Fedi Sapta, which means like to do the Saturday. But it's the opposite of resting, because it was a way of showing their Christian neighbors, like, look, I'm working on a Saturday, so I'm trying to let you know that I actually converted to Christianity. I'm not trying to keep the Shabbat in secret. They also did things like eating pork in the entrances of their houses, and that's where the one of the possibilities of the name Chueta coming from, the word chua, which means like a pork rib, because people would cook and eat them outside of their houses as a way to confirm that they were not crypto Jews, because you could go to prison if you were.
Wow, that's super fascinating. I hadn't really thought about it, because I've heard a lot about people like lighting candles or something in secret, but I hadn't heard about the other side of it where it's like you really need to show the society that you are Christian. And I hadn't really put that together of what that would look like in sort of cultural rituals that get passed down from generation to generation. Levi or Katie, would you like to go next?
My family is from Cuba, from my paternal side, from many generations, but he is of Sephardic descent. And with my mom's mom, it's not very clear, but like the last names are related to Sephardic people in the Caribbean, but I don't really know. The like most recent Sephardic side of the family is my dad's and my mom's dad. And they came, well, statistically, they were expelled from Sephardic and they went to Turkey or Syria. The thing is, my great-grandmother from that side was in Barcelona in the beginning of the 20th century, on the last years of the 19th. And for what I've read, possibly, yes, Ottoman Jews that lived in Barcelona, some convert to Catholicism, some didn't. But yeah, Judaism before the 1968 was not prohibited. There was like freedom of worship. I'm looking. Yeah, in 1869, there was freedom of worship. But in 1969, they abolished the Alhambra decree. There was Jewish people, but there wasn't like a public Jewish life. My great grandparents and my grandfather and his brothers were in Spain until like 1944 or something. And then my great-grandfather was in a concentration camp somewhere, reunited with them in Cuba in 46. There is some notion that we came from Turkey in the 19th century, but there's not a lot.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, family histories can be very confusing. So being able to know that much about the specific places your ancestors went, it's honestly quite a privilege to be able to know even that much. And I honestly hadn't heard that much about the Alhambra decrees being in law until the 60s. That's kind of crazy. For people that don't know, the Alhambra decrees are the decrees that were formalizing the expulsion of Jews from Spain in the 1492. And that's almost 500 years of it being in law, which is wild.
Also kind of symbolic that it's the same year that Columbus arrived in America, so-called. Yeah, that was a rough year.
But it's also very interesting that your family ended up meeting in Cuba, of all places, which was a bastion of Spanish Empire until the 1890s.
In the 19th, the same period I was talking about, there were a lot of Sephardic Jews from Aleppo and Syria that were going to Latin America in general, but specifically to Cuba. Big percentage of entire towns moved down there. And until the 50s or so, there was a pretty strong diaspora in Cuba, both Sephardic and Ashkenazi.
Yeah, I heard a little bit, but I wonder why so many Jews came to Cuba at that time. I mean, it wasn't really a bastion of democracy like it claimed to be.
No, but
who knows? Katie, do you want to tell us a little bit about your family history and what brought you to Spain?
Yeah, and now for something completely different. So yeah, I'm Katie. I'm like three parts Scandinavian, Germanic, Protestant, and one part German, Jewish. I'm very German, really. I'm like very Northern European in terms of my family history. And so I'm like a big, I mean, I'm like the world's proudest gayer. I'm a convert. I'm very passionate about it. My relationship to diasporism and doing Jewish where I am is really different and comes, I think, less from my family and more from the way that are my like my ancestors and more from the way I was raised. My parents were diplomats and I was, Spain is the 14th country I've lived in. I moved every couple of years from like 6 months after I was born. I mean, I often joked I'm like the wanderingest Jew of all time. And I love it. And it gives me this sense of like my relationship to, you know, I've ended up being literally a professional Jew. It's what I do with my day job. I work for a really cool organization called Judaism Unbound. I used to do a lot of lay leadership stuff in the United Kingdom. And so I'm just like desperately passionate about like an accessible Judaism that's rooted in place. I started my Jewish journey in Germany. I was in the United Kingdom. Now I'm here. I have close connections to the US and the Jewish community there. So I think that's the lens. It's one of the main lenses that I come. I happen to be in Spain. Like I'm a Jew who happens to be in Spain. Like,
how long have you been in Spain?
Not long, like a year and 7 months. Like a year and a half.
Wow. That kind of does bring us to the next part of that question, which is how does this relate to your understanding of diasporism? Because it sounds like you all have very different family histories and relationships to Judaism and Jewishness, but you've still kind of all come together around this idea of diasporism, which doesn't have a dictionary definition at this point, but still sounds like something that resonates with each of you for different and maybe even personal reasons. So I was wondering if one of you could articulate what diasporism means to you, and then we can go from there.
A short answer would be, for me, living with our neighbors, being part of like the social fabric in whatever way we can. Here in the Spanish state, it's kind of difficult because as Jews, we don't have like a social place anymore. Yeah, in the Middle Ages, we were silversmiths and that kind of thing. But this is a state that developed as a modern state without Muslim presence, without Jewish presence, being the closest one could get to being an ethnostate in that period. So it's not easy wanting to create a kind of strong diasporic movement in a country that negates you, that doesn't want to acknowledge you are there, but also acknowledge how much of themselves are us. Kind of maybe in Poland, there's something similar. And right now, as diasporist in Spain, for me, the most important field of action, if we can say like that, would be migrant rights, like anti-racism, obviously all forms of liberation.
Spain having such a strong cultural identity that is basically a Frankenstein monster of all those peoples who do live here, but somehow are considered not Spanish enough or not actually Spanish, but ended up being like the source where all these cultural references of Spain come from. And it happens with the Jewish population, but not only with us, it also happens with Romani people, with Muslims and Arabs. And I mean, this territory has been under Muslim law for a long time, and it's obviously had an impact on how we live here today. Any other group of people who are not seen as white default Spanish people? So to me, I connect to diaspora. I mean, I usually understand diaspora as the group of people who are forced to leave their place of origin. And that is definitely not my case, or at least not because of my Jewishness. But that is a whole other conversation for another day. But I kind of connect to the sense of people in the diaspora because I feel in Mallorca, most of the things that are now considered folk and traditional and very authentic things, such as ensaimada or...
What is that?
Ensaimada is like a big, the one that looks like a spiral and it's just really big and you can like make it...
Or like a pastry?
Yeah, it's like a pastry, almost flaky pastry covered in powdered sugar.
I'll have to try that someday.
It's actually delicious. But like that has a shit ton of pork fat. And it's like most of the cultural authentic foods in Mallorca are cooked with pork fat because that was what the Jewish community was doing to keep preparing the food they were used to, but to make it not Jewish, to escape this persecution. So what is now a symbol of the island, and you can get it on any souvenir store as a pin or a magnet for your fridge, was actually a Rosh Hashanah challah, which is you make it round, representing the time and the whole cycle of the year, instead of just doing the regular braid. And that ended up being something that the rest of the population in Mallorca took as if it was culturally theirs, just because the Jewish community that did not want to leave had to like create an option to kind of keep doing their thing, but without getting caught.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the same happens with, I don't know, flamenco or any other things that are considered culturally Spanish. And I kind of connect to the diaspora through that, of seeing how you can be seen as a second type of citizen or even like a half citizen, but your culture is taken away from you somehow.
Yeah, no, that just makes me think of like when I first came to the idea of diasporism. I'm sure many people have had a similar experience where you just come to the idea, you're not really sure where it came from, but you're like, it just kind of intuitively makes sense. But one of the first characteristics that I was like, this feels like a diasporist idea, is like this really radical intercultural exchange where something that might come from one culture then gets shared with the wider society. And then you're speaking to the fact that it kind of almost gets lost to the fact that this was Jewish, because if you're having to cook it all with pork fat, it's a very minor change. It's like you're using something that would make it unkosher rather than just butter or a different type of oil. Fat or oil. Yeah. But it also does then fit into this wider monolithic culture of the area that just kind of flattens it, but does show just how important that diaspora community is at the end of the day to constituting that more monolithic understanding of culture in the area.
Speaking of oil, using olive oil, which is like super Spanish now, was something that Spanish people then make fun of and shamed because it was like a Jewish thing, using olive oil.
That's fascinating because like I was in Andalusia last year and I believe it's like the olive oil capital of the world. There were olive groves for miles and miles and miles. Yeah. So it's so clearly such a major aspect of at least Andalusian or Spanish culture that it's interesting that it's not originating from that.
I didn't know that.
The whole idea of Spain is, like Lidith was saying, like a Frankenstein monster.
No, I was just really emotional about the olives.
Yeah.
They're just like taking care of our olives is like one of the times when I feel most profoundly Jewish. And I didn't know that there was that association. I knew Jews farmed olives here. This valley.
Yeah, I mean, I do want to talk about that monolithic Spanishness and how diaspora kind of undermines it, as well as what we just said, like kind of constitutes it at the end of the day when it's lost. But I also want to hear a little bit about your conception of diasporism, Katie, because you have a very different relationship to Jewishness, as well as being that wandering ger, have like a very interesting understanding of what it means to be in relationship to place.
I sit in two sort of places. I think particularly in Spain, it's even more different being a foreigner and being in this, in a position of coming from really quite robust Jewish communities. I'm really in love in that way that I think you can be when you sort of stumble upon something. Like, I'm really in love with these like little, very specific little Jewish histories. So particularly like learning about the region where I'm in and learning about like agriculture and learning about. For my birthday, I got this great book. My soon-to-be ex-husband, who's the best, got me this book, which is Jewish Symbols and Secrets, a 15th century Spanish carpet about, it's in Murcia, so it's not from near me, but about these like hidden symbols in carpets. And the key is that among the things that I do out here in the countryside is help raise sheep, wool, sheep that are bred for wool and for making rugs. And I make tzitzit with them. And so the reason I bring all of this sort of stuff up is like that to me is how I'm engaging with it, is picking up threads. Like the place where I am has a Jewish story. Not every place does. Mine has a really cool Jewish story. And it's not well documented, but it is documented. And this is generally my outlook on Judaism in general. Like it feels like there is space to be generative here and in diaspora in general by having, you know, this relationship that Lithe and Levi have both talked about, this close relationship with the culture and this dialogue with the culture. And that also, like, it's easy, right? It's easy to come in from the outside and be like, we're going to generate new ideas and we're going to generate new ways of doing this. But I'm really struck for many reasons, I think largely the traveling, with the idea that the Jewish story of any place is written by the Jews in that place. Like if you are a Jew in that place, living your life, engaging with it, you are, it sounds very self-important, but I think every diasporist who chooses to be like, I'm going to be in a close dialogue with the land, with the earth. I mean, I think diasporism, like as a person who spends a lot of my time working on a farm and like caring a lot about a farm, like I think it's a really natural place because we were ripped from the land everywhere. And not, it's full of trauma, but it's also like a real place for healing. And the land requires you to pay attention to the place, right? You're looking to nurture native species when you're deciding what to weed and not to weed in your garden. You're looking for people.
That's something that's come together in Miknaf Haaretz, a group in Britain, really focuses on that connection to place through agricultural work.
Close friends. Yeah, no, what Miknaf Haaretz are doing are absolutely incredible. And that's really, Sarah Moon is one of the people who taught me this. Like Sarah is a teacher who taught me this.
Our 10th episode was interviewing Sarah and Samson from Miknaf Haaretz. So if you haven't listened to that, we really recommend going back to it. It was a really wonderful conversation about connecting to place through that sort of agricultural work. And that's something that as Jews in diaspora were really have a long history of being prevented from being able to do that. So it really can be healing to really cut through that trauma of being actually expelled from the land and unable to work it. And that's something that is very healing and also really beautiful because, I mean, we live in a world where increasingly every little thing is commodified. So being able to be on the land and caring for plants and being able to see something grow and harvest, it's really beautiful to be in connection to that. And it's human because there's such a long history of it, but we live in a moment where that's just increasingly cut off from our daily lives. So it's really nice to be able to do that. So I also wanted to speak to the fact that, Katie, you mentioned something that for me has been really meaningful as well, which is the fact that when you do travel as a Jewish diasporist, you're able to really focus on like, oh, I want to learn about the Jewish history of this area. And like I went to Andalusia last year, and that was something that was constantly on my mind of like, there is a very rich Jewish history in this area that is cut off from the modern day in a lot of ways from this trauma. And at the same time, you're able to see a few sites. Like I visited in Cordoba, this one tiny little synagogue that was like some person's individual synagogue, but it had these beautiful, I don't know what to call it, but very similar to what you'd see in like a Islamic palace where you'd have this type of art on the wall that is very geometric and three-dimensional. But rather than it being purely geometric and having Arabic and stuff, it had images of like pomegranates and Hebrew and these Jewish images that are integrating the local style with their Jewishness that I thought was really incredible to see in the way that these cultures related to each other and built on each other in a way that's really, really beautiful because it really cuts across the monolithic Spanishness that you often might see in the forefront. And that's something I kind of wanted to move towards now because Spanish identity is already, you've called it a Frankenstein's monster. It's something that isn't really monolithic. You have Andalusian identity, you have Basque identity, you have Catalonian identity, you have all these different regional identities that somewhat fit into this understanding of Spanishness. And then you also might have a Jewish Spanish identity that might be different as well, and that is constituted by a broader international diasporism relating to one's Jewish identity and the relationship to place that you have within that long Jewish history of Spain and the land you're in. So I was kind of wondering how your diasporism might relate to conversations around the cultural and political autonomy in Spain. I know Catalonian regionalism is really prominent in the news often, but I was wondering how these place-based understandings of cultural autonomy might run contrary or relate to your understanding of diasporism in Spain.
I would say for the most part, the places you can clearly see the cultural differences. Most of them, if not all, have some sort of independence movement of wanting to separate themselves from the Spanish idea, or even like the Spanish country and the Spanish culture and everything else, as in most of the in the Basque country, in the Catalonia, or even in Andalusia, there's some people who would not want them to be related to Spain as a concept, which I can relate to that. In the sense of, I kind of hate this country, like from the deepest of my guts. But on the other side, I do like the idea of, and I take pride on the idea that I live, right now I live in Barcelona, and I like to think of this place, regardless of whether it would be Spanish or Catalan legally and in terms of like, states and things like that, the actual people living here and the people you interact with on your everyday basis is so diverse and it's so rich. And you have people with a very, very different background of yours, but somehow ended up sharing things. Because when you grow up in the same place, even if inside your house, the family would have culturally traditions and rituals that vary a lot, you can have like a common ground on nostalgia or things of your childhood that you used to do, or places where these people can meet and you ended up sharing with. In that moment, I think the idea of all of us sharing an identity regarding of state is completely vanished. We do not feel united because we're all under Spanish IDs and this sense of sharing a country, but more of sharing the land at the end of the day, the streets and your neighbors. I kind of relate more to the people who also separate themselves from the state and people who tend to identify strongly with the state of Spain. To me, it's people who do what I was trying to explain before of this is not mine, but I'm going to take it as if it was mine, just because you and I were born on the same place. And also will take pride on the things Spanish has done to your people as something to identify as. Mm-hmm. On the same sentence. That's what shocks me the most about Spain. Like, you get flamenco and other things like strongly felt as something very Spanish, but then you also have it with tapas and jamón serrano, which, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love tapas, free food. It's a hit. We love it. We want it to stay. But it started and it originated as a way to kind of see if your neighbors were Christians or not. Because if you go and get a drink and they serve you pork and you do not eat it when it's free, it's kind of like giving away your non-Christian status. And that's how all this culture around jamón serrano, like, that's why Spanish people love it so much, because it ended up being a symbol of, if you eat that, you're actually Spanish, you're actually from here. But they combine things that they stole from other people that were persecuting and things that they did to persecute them, and now it's smashed as if it were the same thing. But that's how I see it, as a Frankenstein monster, because it crumbles all over.
Yeah, that's fascinating to be able to have cultural rituals that literally come out of a form of persecution that are then just so cherished. You can appreciate them for their own beauty of, I mean, it's free food. That's a really wonderful tradition. But also, like, are people even aware of that longer history? Or is that something that people just kind of take for granted?
Most of them don't even know, because it's something that it's completely erased and not discussed. because the state is constantly washing their face. It's not something that you're taught.
There's, I think, fundamentally, the position here often feels like begging. I think if you want to engage in figuring out and talking about and thinking about Jewishness within the Spanish state now, it's so much about like begging people to see what's right there. Some guy on a road was like, basically, by the way, this place used to have a lot of Jews. He didn't know I was Jewish. He was telling me about something else. He's like, there's some Muslim towers over there. Do you want to come on this walk that I'm hosting tomorrow? And I was like, oh, Muslims. He's like, oh, yeah. Andalusia came really close to here. And actually, this was like a center of Jewish and Muslim life. What? And like that history exists. And I've been sitting trying to figure out how through like art I can like try to tell people, because it's the same with the Muslim quarter. I live in a town of 400 people. It was not always this small. It's so much about begging people. Like there were Muslims here and they mattered a lot and they like helped you give birth to your children. And like there were Jews here and they defined the economy and they like allowed this mountain pass that we're in to be functional. And they came back. Like there were Jews who loved this land so much that even though they only spent 150 years in this part of the world for various reasons, they left after the pogroms in the 1390s. Like I have stories, the stories of people who like leave this little town, go to Morocco and go back, come back here to this little town and like buy back their olive groves. The thing is, Jews loved this place and I just want people to know that. And Muslims loved this place and these people and they stayed and like, I just want someone to see it. And I think it's true with so much. I didn't know about the jamón thing. Like that makes so much sense. Cocido, which is like the most wonderful dish from Madrid, is like very, very suspiciously cooked, just like and similar to a traditional Sephardic.
It was Jewish.
Yeah.
Like Holland, right? The one cooked on the Shabbat that you just keep on. It just cooks overnight, right?
Yeah. So a traditional one here in Spain would have acelgas and it would have chickpeas. It would have the garbanzos that the cocido has. It's right there.
Yeah, I do want to just kind of go back to your collective, Sirpad. It seems very recent. And I was kind of wanting to know a little bit about what you see as the purpose of your collective, as well as where it fits within this wider international ecosystem of left-wing Jewish groups in Europe and the US and wherever they exist.
Initially, the idea was like a group centered around, we kind of know each other or know a couple of people, centered around cultural things, but with the ongoing attack on Gaza and the genocide, we use this group for activism because the only other Jewish anti-Zionist group on a state level, not only in Catalonia. In Catalonia, there's Junts per Palestina. And the other one was IJAN and wasn't accessible for us at the time.
So just for listeners that don't know, IJAN is the International Anti-Zionist Network. They have branches all over the world. But why is it not accessible? Or why have you found it not accessible?
In that moment, it wasn't easy to communicate with them. I guess they were very busy that day.
Yeah, of course.
We've been in contact with people from IJAN, it's not a problem. And we weren't like a queer group initially, but in the second international meeting in Barcelona for solidarity with Palestine, we needed to be a queer group and we are all queer. So it wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, for our things with the Eurovision boycott, after Eurovision, we'll do Pride-related things. Queer Coalition for Palestine.
Out of curiosity, how do you relate to the wider Jewish community in Spain? Are you guys engaging with them at all? Are you guys really alienated from them?
Going to shul together and then crying about it afterwards?
Yeah.
Is it extremely Zionist and that's really alienating to you guys?
Yeah. We don't participate as much. There are more overtly Zionist communities, but yeah, they're all Zionist, which kind of makes sense. I mean, because there wasn't a diasporic community here. It's not great.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about you say there wasn't diasporic community here. Could you tell us a little bit about the history of the modern Jewish community in Spain and like its institutions, if you know?
There were one Jewish community before 1968 because of the Alhambra decree. But yes, there are like 13,000 Jews in Spain. There's very few Jewish people here. I think that community was in Barcelona, but I don't have a timeline of the communities here.
In general, like a lot of Europe, it's skewed very Orthodox. The fact that there's a Reform community in Madrid founded by four women, how long ago? 15, 20 years, I don't know. That's quite new. But I think that the contemporary Orthodoxy being the mainstream, you can feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I noticed that a lot when I did a year in Britain for my master's, and I noticed just how different it was compared to the breakdown denominationally in the United States, where like Reform is the biggest movement. In Britain, it was much more Orthodox, and you could really feel it in the way it kind of shifted norms around. Like, I did some student politics out there, and at the UJS conference, it kind of skewed towards the most Orthodox common denominator. It was like, because we have 40% Orthodox, everyone's basically going to act Orthodox for this weekend in public.
Even more like that here. Like, the whole history of Reform and liberal Judaism in the UK is basically absent because of repression. Spain is not only under the Alhambra decree, but like a dictator also until...
Yeah, no, that's really interesting because I don't think there's ever... I haven't found anything regard to like why that is in terms of like the breakdown. I think it might have to do with much more intentional resettlement of Orthodox communities in these places post-Holocaust and stuff. It might have to, I don't know. I think it kind of raises a question about like the long-term future of the diasporist movement, because we talk about diasporism and one of the key issues being like the freedom of movement and migrants' rights and anti-racism. And it makes me wonder if the goal of diasporism internationally is to enable people to have a freedom of movement so that they can live where they would like to live. And if that's something that might, in terms of this wider ecosystem of Jewish groups and stuff that lives around the world, whether they be Orthodox, Reform, Zionist, anti-Zionist, if this is something that could be changed by a better organized diasporist movement internationally. Because I know Zach and I were talking, I think before this, that I am eligible for Polish citizenship, but the easiest way to do it is to like pay a lawyer a bunch of money to fill out the forms in Polish. But Zach was like, if only you had a podcast co-host that speaks Polish and lives in Poland. And I was like, oh. And then we made the point that if we were to set up, I know Levi, at least you are involved in the effort to reform the International Jewish Labor Bund. The historical Bund had a migration department that helped Jews emigrate and immigrate to different places. And it could be something that allows Jews, especially to exercise these birthright citizenships, because I know Poland has this, that if you have ancestry in the country going back to 1920 or later, you're able to immigrate and become a Polish citizen. I think it even says like you are a Polish citizen, you just need to get that recognized by the Polish state. And that kind of brings me to another question about Spain, because I know that Spain, at least for a time, allowed people with Sephardic ancestry to claim citizenship, but I believe that's no longer the case. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
It was the case until 2019. I don't know why it stopped.
Probably because of racism.
Yeah, probably. Most Jews here are from Spanish-speaking countries, at least in Madrid.
Yeah, in Barcelona too. Well, my relation to the Jewish community here, or literally anywhere, I'm very selective since I started the journey of connecting with my ancestry and returning to Judaism and being a part of the community, et cetera, et cetera. And I did that on my early 20s. I started when I was like 20 years old or so. And in that moment, I already came out as trans. I already had like a very strong filter of the people I want to hang out and have in my life in general. So the Jewish community that I have contact with both locally and nationally are Jews that are closer to what I believe and stand on matters of Zionism or even Orthodoxy and Reform and yada, yada, yada. I think that has a big role on the fact that most of the Jewish people I hang out with, not all of them are Spanish speaking, and they don't come from a Spanish speaking country. But because most of the Jewish community that has been here for a long time and they all know each other and these kind of things is usually filled with Zionists, or how I would like to call them, like more of a more leaning to white supremacy, even inside their Jewishness, somehow even sometimes having a priority of Ashkenazi tradition, even though the majority of people in that moment are not from Ashkenazi descent and things like that.
Yeah, that happens here too.
And that's kind of like the part of the Jewish community I don't engage with. And that's kind of the majority of the people. I would not say the people I hang out with is a good example to have an opinion on how the Jewish community is in general in here.
Here in Madrid, what I've seen, generally right-wing people of Latin American countries is a lot of people.
The majority of the Jewish people we hang out with, yeah. Either that or left-wing that from the States or other places that maybe they speak in another language and we communicate in English because it's the one we have in common. There's a lot of English and Spanish language usage at the same time in most of my Jewish gathering.
Now, that multilingual nature is something that I understand very much as part of diasporist practice. And unfortunately, I am monolingual like most Americans. Would love if that were changed, and I've tried learning multiple languages. It's hard to learn a language when you then learn another language. Like I took 2.5 years of Hebrew and there was like a year of overlap and then they just jumbled in my head and I can do neither of them on their own, and it's a shame. But
imagine you ended up knowing Ladino just speaking Spanish and Hebrew at the same time.
You're primed. You are ready.
That's true. Do you guys have a relationship with Ladino? That's an interesting question as you guys are focused on sort of cultural work.
In my case, not with the language, but I've come to know, like researching or things like that, that a lot of things my mom told me are like, yeah, Sephardic.
Oh, that's
like,
a hard one.
Like sayings.
See, like sayings.
Yeah, but it kind of has a different...
Like proverbs? Like,
yeah. See,
it's more of a proverb, I would say. It's like a mix between a proverb and a saying. Because it's very informal and you can use it very often, and it's not that of that deep of a like philosophical thought and that a proverb may have, but it's also not as random as just a regular saying. It's usually comes from a cultural source or origin of the life in the area.
Yeah, so you've been bringing out certain sayings in Ladino, but that's the extent?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't speak it, but I understand it. When I started doing all this return to Judaism, since I kind of wanted to focus or tried to focus on things that were specifically taken away from the people in my family lineage, I ended up focusing a lot on researching things that were written in Ladino. So I didn't end up like incorporating in my daily practice things that, even though they're Jewish, they might not have been remotely similar to what my family would have done. So Ladino took a really important part in my conversion pathway.
Yeah.
Because it was a way for me to make sure that had like a direct link to what I was trying to get back.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's super important. And the journey reconnecting with Judaism like that, especially in a cultural way, being able to reconnect to language is something that's really potent. For me, all my ancestry is Ashkenazi. And when I went to Poland last year and was surrounded by more Yiddish speakers and started listening to Yiddish music, it's a way that I really was able to reconnect to a different side of, a different kind of Judaism than the one I was taught in synagogues and in camps that were predominantly Zionist. But one thing that I've thought about a lot in regard to the question of like cultural and political autonomy and the sort of end goals of diasporism, as I might understand it in a political sense, is really, of course, in opposition to the increasing tendency towards anti-migrant politics. And we see in Europe, like this idea of like fortress Europe, of this really anti-migrant stronghold of white Christian Western civilization that's manifesting even in certain so-called social democratic parties. I know in like Scandinavia, we've seen Denmark's social democratic party, they claim to be on the left, but then they're super anti-migrant. And Spain, you guys have a ostensibly left-wing government at this point. I don't know where it stands in regard to migrant politics. At the end of the day, it's not necessarily what we might see as the end goal of a left-wing vision. I was kind of wondering how you understand the end goal of a diasporist politic. Of course, we're opposing all forms of nationalism, whether it be Zionism, Spanish nationalism, but we're also engaging with our cultural roots in a way that might encourage certain forms of regionalism, like we might see in Catalonia or the Basque Country, that might, at the end of the day, still be integrated within a wider pan-European project. So I was kind of wondering if diasporism fits into that pan-European project, or if it's broader than that in terms of an internationalist politics. So what you kind of see as the goal of diasporism, as well as where it fits within the wider understanding of panophony of left-wing politics, which is a smorgasbord, a variety. There's so much difference in left-wing politics, but what you guys kind of see as your end goal, your ideal vision of the future that your guys' work leads towards?
I don't know if that would be the end goal, but a goal would be open borders, effectively, not only for things, because right now borders are kind of open for things, but not for people.
That's a good point.
That would solve so much. But yeah, here, even though we have a nominally left-wing government, the attitude towards migration, obviously just migration of people from the global south, is horrible. Our ministry of Marlaska. What's the... Edit that, please. There are constant attacks on migrant people. Europe being the fortress that you mentioned, has Spain, not only Spain, also Greece and Italy as their most hard border. It's been a decade-long hostility, constant, towards migrants who come in pateras, like small boats.
Yeah, small boats.
Empire doesn't love small boats. Every day, and institutional racism here in Spain is relentless.
As a collective in SILPAD, to me, the focus on diaspora, I think it doesn't stem from only one place. And that's kind of the beauty of it. But for me personally, inside or outside this group that we have, I kind of like want to focus on the fact that I don't believe the solution to the problems the people in the diaspora face are solved with what I would call the biggest ghetto of the world. Because I don't want people kicked out of their houses so I can move to the Middle East. I want to live in peace in here. Please and thank you. So to me, putting the focus on the diaspora is a way of centering again the safety of the people where they are and live right now, instead of trying to fix that with a magical
19th century fantasy.
Everybody wanting to move to the same place. Like, when did that happen ever? So I don't feel safer as a Jew here if I have somewhere else to go. I want to be able to stay here without the need or my safety being compromised if I stay. So kind of like create a space of safety, connecting with other people, community, trying to bring strength to the resistance of our existence where we live now.
Yes, an assertion of belonging to the place you live and not some faraway homeland that you could be sent to, you could be deported to. I know in my research, I found that in like the 1880s, before Zionism was really a thing in Britain, there's accounts of anti-Semites saying, go to Palestine, basically saying, why are the Jews coming here to Britain? Because at the time, they actually did have open borders. But Jews were coming into Britain, Jews were coming to the United States, and they were like, why are you coming here? Go to Palestine where you belong. Where it's this idea that like a certain ethno-religious national group only can really be in the place that, frankly, nationalist worldviews designates for it, and that anywhere else, they're not really going to belong. They're going to undermine that sense of national unity. I think that speaks to your experience in Spain, but also the fact that like the long history of Jews in Spain really undermines that. And I think this conversation has really brought that out and just how constitutive the Jewish diaspora in Spain has been of a lot of Spanish culture, whether it's directly or indirectly, in the sense that these are elements of persecution of Jews that have become cherished cultural traditions. Did you have any ideas, Katie, as well, on the end goal of diasporism?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the end goal of diasporism is a gargantuan question. Like, God bless you for asking it in the last couple of minutes.
Right.
I mean, I certainly have thoughts about, I guess, an end goal for this, for diasporism in Spain, and for what I think, God willing, this is like the beginning of a much longer and bigger story, is challenging the culture of silence around Jewishness. That just means like people have no contact and no idea, and they get stories. And like, we have had this Zionist story specifically. I think like for me, diasporism, it's in relationship to Zionism. Like, it has to be, as long as we have to live with one. I think a successful movement means that people in Spain know they're, I know not everyone's all of a sudden going to have Jewish neighbors, but like people in Spain know their Jewish neighbors and the people in their, you know, the communities where they are. And I think continually building positive identities and reclaiming and telling stories in as many venues as possible for ourselves, for people who know that they're Jewish and don't know what to do about it. Like, there's still so much hiding. You can get away with wild stuff. Like in the part of Spain where I live, like people regularly cheer at, on Semana Santa, they do like a toast called Mata Judios, just like kill the Jews. And they'll like all raise their glasses and go, kill the Jews. Please, what? No one edit me out and like cancel me. It's genuinely a thing. My colleague during Semana Santa was like, Katie, is this where you live? And I was like, oh my God, it is. But the fact that there was a town actually called it, and it was only recently changed.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say.
That's God. The same reference.
They changed the name to Mata de Judíos, that would be like plant of Jews.
Which makes no sense.
Yeah. Well, but it's preferable.
It's the silence. Where's the conversation about it? They quietly changed the name of the town. It's an entire tradition. Like, yeah.
And Matamoros is a last name.
Oh, good.
Wow.
So yeah, I think we have a long way to go.
Yeah.
I think that Jewish, Spanish, diasporist, whatever, Iberian, Sephardi, whatever it is, matters as its own thing as well. I think that's really another thing to not lose, is it really matters to keep it alive and to teach like the people who want. I think if you like want to live here, I think it's really important to deeply like learn and respect the way that Jewish is done here. And I think if we can have that all over, like imagine getting to land somewhere and someone's like, all right, this is how we do this here. Like, you got this. Yeah. Like, here's the, I don't know, the Jewish catalog of contemporary like Sephardi ideas, right?
I really am so grateful to have had the chance to speak with you guys. I think we've covered such a wide variety of topics, and I feel like I've learned a lot. And I just wanted to say that for me, diasporism, I think it's important that you name this, Katie, is inherently in dialogue with Zionism and is trying to ultimately subvert it, in a sense that Zionism is a form of nationalism. It tries to flatten the narrative of Jewish history. It's one grand narrative that can be applied everywhere, that Jews are in danger in diaspora, and the only place they can really be is in Palestine, in Jerusalem, in Zion. But we know that's not true. Jewish history shows that's not true. And diasporism, as something that's inherently under-national, I mean, it's national in the sense that it's constitutive of Jews as a people, but it's not nationalist. It doesn't try to assert claim over one specific place. It shows that Jews have lived all over the world and have taken part in the nations that they've lived among, whether it's Spain, whether it's Argentina or the United States, Jews have found ways to be Jewish in these different spaces and contribute to the societies and ultimately make them far greater and more culturally vibrant than they would be without them, of course. And in doing that, in subverting Zionism in the sense that it's not one grand narrative, there's all these different communities around the world that are scattered, but in dialogue with each other, should be in dialogue with each other, and trying to fight for a better world. Ultimately, I think diasporism is really significant because it has the potential of helping us reroute that sort of curiosity and pride in one's ancestry that is, I think, inherent in that sort of thing that ultimately has been historically used towards fueling nationalism. And it could redirect it in a sense that we can be in place. I think, Levi, you named it so well in a way that I hadn't really put it together. It's just living with each other, living with your neighbors in a way that isn't claiming exclusive dominion over one place, but recognizing that there's a variety of people and kinds of people and diversity in these places, and that there's richness in that. And ultimately, diasporism might allow us to undermine nationalism in a way that other forms of left-wing politics have failed, because other forms of left-wing politics have been so focused on capitalism that they've kind of missed the fact that nationalism is a driving force in history as well, and in a force that has ultimately led to fascism or been a key component in what led to fascism. And we're seeing that play out in Palestine today. And it's so important for us to be able to take our Jewish roots and emphasize that that's not what Judaism is. It's not a nationalist project. It's a cultural heritage that we can creatively engage with and generate new forms of cultural practice and identity that is so much more beautiful than any form of nationalism could be at the end of the day.
The only thing I'm going to say is stolen from my org, which is that we are all artists and Judaism is our medium.
Thank you so much.
And viva Palestina Libre.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Amen.